Maybe a small startup running a private program will have like a small cheese, so a small set of holes. But giant companies has like a way bigger market share, so the cheese is big. And so there is more holes. And that's how I approach my targets right now. The metaphor works, and I will fight anyone that say otherwise.
Alrighty, Richard, what's on the docket for today? Oh, an ASMR ad? Say less. I got you. All right, guys. So today we're going to... attack surface management roles, not AS... Okay, I got you. Well, if we're talking about attack surface management, then of course we're talking about the AcidNote team, right? The OGs in the ASM space. And this time around, they've released a new community project, their attack surface management job board, a place where you can see all of the companies that are hiring for attack surface management jobs. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, if you're a recon heavy hacker, or if you just want to get your hands on the AcidNote product to play around with it, then definitely check out that job board. That's going to be at acidnote.io/ASMR. I'm going to make them change it to ASMR. So if you want to support the pod, or if you want to check out that job board, head over to acidnote.io/ASMR. All right, back to the show. Let's go. All righty, man. Here we are.
Hey.
It's been a fun week. We are sitting down right now in Grenoble at Ronnie's studio here. And
exactly.
I came into town for Grehack, and Ronnie
Grehack.
I can't get the R correct, but Ronnie has shown me an excellent time. And you know, I had a plan for this pod, Ronnie, but then you had a plan as well for this pod. And
it seems I'm so sorry.
No, I'm open to it. I'm open to it, man. We're just okay. Chilling. So what were you thinking?
Yeah, I was thinking that recently I've been helping a friend of mine getting into bug bounty hunting. And the interesting thing is that from someone that is completely beginner, just a little bit passionate about computers, I noticed like how hard it is to get all the concepts that we know today, right? And and you did like a great thread at the time on Twitter that I actually sent it to him, and I'm noticing how he's trying to learn from your thread. And I think that beginners tutorials needs to be a bit more hardcore.
I see. Okay.
And so the goal is like, for instance, in your thread, the first thing that comes to mind is like the web fundamentals, right? And like, how do you really start into web? What do you learn exactly? And there's so many, you know, resources, but I guess like the best ones are the most technical ones. And if you start with the hardest one, like the RFC, the MDN documentation, stuff like that, you are going to get to the roots and the fundamentals of what is really web, and that will help you for your bug bounty journey.
I'm going to go ahead and pull up the tweet right here. We'll show it on the screen. But essentially, it's just a description of what I would do over the course of a year if I was to try to go from zero to 100K in bug bounty. And yeah, web fundamentals, I think that's one of the areas where I've gotten the most questions.
Yes.
You know, is like, what does a web fundamental, you know, education include. So yeah, we can talk a little bit about that. And I think also, you know, this may be one of the episodes, one of the rare episodes of critical thinking that might be a little bit more beginner oriented. But I think as more advanced hackers as well, it can be helpful to reflect on these things, not only for the purposes of being able to teach them to the next generation of hackers, but also as sort of a reflection ourselves on the basics and what it looks like to develop those basics.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially since we were talking about like availability that you saw an article about on GitHub where it's used like the head verb HTTP verb as a way to exploit it, and like it just shows that sometimes you need to go back to the roots and the basics and go way deeper into the you know, the fundamentals of what is the technology that the technologies that you are trying to hack, and how, like, as an expert in the field and how as a beginner you can go straight to the, you know, yeah, the root of that kind of technology in order to restart your exploitation journey.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's really pivotal too about learning hacking, because we were talking in that same conversation as we were hiking up the mountain.
Exactly.
you know, that when you hacking is sort of a unique thing, because it's not like once you learn it, you're good. You know, like every single time we hack something, we are relearning. You know, we have to take that product, that application or whatever, and we have to break it down just like we did in the beginning when we were learning the skills for hacking, and find the problems with it. And so we can't really teach hacking without teaching the ability to learn, the ability to learn an application and that whole flow. And I think we can apply that as well. You know, we do it every time we hack an application. We do what we needed to do, you know, back in the day when we were just starting. Except, you know, at that point we're doing it against a whole industry, a whole set of technologies, HTTP, you know, web browsers, that sort of thing. So it's a lot wider scale, right? You know, you might say it's the biggest set of applications there might be out there, but it's the same principles just applied at a larger scale, and then at a smaller scale once you sort of have the basic understanding of what vulnerabilities exist on these sort of attack surfaces.
Yeah, and there is something that you are grasping right now that I think a lot of beginners, but I know also a lot of really expert people in the field that are trying to get into bug bounty, so that bug bounty beginners, but already expert in cybersecurity, is that the ability to find the good resources in order to help you exploit some vulnerabilities. Like the question that we get the most in our DMs is like, okay, where do I learn stuff? Like how I find the information? And I think this is a huge problem for us to answer this one, because the goal is not to give the knowledge to someone. It's like to give the ability for them to find their own knowledge. Because when you are going to get like this really weird technology that exists just on two web servers in the world, you are not going to get a Google search or anyone on earth that is going to know it, right? You need to go down into the documentation, the technical spec, and really understand it yourself. And that's how you really find the information. Just trying to face the most technical and root thing. And if we take your thread, the web fundamentals, where when I'm trying to teach someone, I'm just give like them the MDN documentation, which is, I would say, the beginner friendly version of some RFC. And then I tell them like to try to find the same information in the RFC that is more complete, right? So when you are learning HTTP, it's great to actually learn what is HTTP, what it's built on top of. So TCP, TCP/IP, how do you reach a domain? What is a host? What is an IP? And everything. And like go to the root fundamentals, because sometimes in those routes, there is like some big vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I mean that's the kind of stuff you see with James Kettle all the time. Is he's you know sort of peeling back those layers and addressing the vulnerabilities at a lower level. I think that's definitely important. I think it's difficult to give also resources like MDN or the RFC or whatever and say like, hey, these are the you know source of truth for these things, because at the end of the day, like you said, you have to go and find them, you know?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, absolutely. Reading the RFC and the MDN is a really great resource and something that we should do. But there's also going to be, you know, those random little forums out there, you know, with some old Linux geezer, you know, that knows that was there when this, you know, obscure protocol was created, and you got to read that too. And so it's a lot of digging and a lot of, like you said, you know, not necessarily being intimidated by these highly technical documents, because at the end of the day, this is what I always tell myself, you know, when I'm shaking in my boots in front of like this, you know, very scary target, is like, at the end of the day, somebody not that much smarter than me probably, you know, wrote this whole thing, right? Yes. Right. And, you know, sure, there are some, like, you know, mega genius people out there that are just, you know, leagues above us all. But I feel like given enough time, I can compensate for the difference, you know? And so, you know, remembering that these people aren't gods, you know, that this is not something beyond my, you know, ability to grasp. We just have to put in the time to get there. Yep. I think, and then also, you know, on the web fundamentals, just going back to the nuts and bolts of the web fundamentals, I think it's hard to know where to draw the line on those sort of things, right? Like, do I need to know what every single header does? You know, do I need to know what every single object on window, you know, in the JS engine of Google, you know, Chromium or whatever, do I need to know what all those means? And the answer is no, but it wouldn't hurt, you know, you can always spend more time going down that path. And that's one of the reasons why in this article, I outline, or in the tweet thread, I outline this ratio of hacking to learning, where in the beginning, you're going to be spending, you know, 80% of your time or more on learning. But it's very important to get that, you know, 20%, 10% of the time actually hacking, so you know where things are making a difference.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting thing. Like, on trying to learn everything. Like, where do you stop? Like, do you need every header? And I think, like, you need to learn enough to be able to manipulate yourself the data, and to be able to find back where you can learn the, for instance, like a specific header. You need to know where in the documentation you can find it back.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's not about learning, like having like the strong knowledge of the RFC. It's about trying to understand how you can read the RFC in order to find back the knowledge, right? I think there is an Einstein quote, or at least many people attribute that to Einstein, saying like, why would you search something, like why would you know something that you can search for, right? And I think it's true to some degree. Like, you need to understand the overall concept, like the abstract of it. But the day you are going to need to get, you know, your hands dirty, you need to find back where you learn this from, and in order to go even deeper in this specific technology.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've struggled with as well, is like, as far as needing a good notes system for that sort of thing, right? Like, I'll often think, oh, I know I read an article where there was like some similar technology to this, and I just need to find that now, you know? And I can't find it, no matter, you know, how well I Google dork. And for a little while I was using like this clipper, like the Evernote clipper or something like that. But I've since stopped using that, and I feel like I need to find a good solution for that again, you know, to be able to reach back and grab that. But I guess what other stuff do we need to cover in the web fundamentals area? I mean, I guess one of the things I always talk over with the beginners is like, what is actually happening when you are interacting with a web server via your web browser, right?
Yeah, I feel like even before, like, how it is interacting, I feel that you need to learn how you need to interact yourself with the backend system that you are trying to reach. But again, I guess it's better,
like curl.
Yeah, using like curl, or maybe like, even a Netcat or something.
Like Netcat and like printf.
Yeah, like just for one single reason. How many times you sent a GET request on Burp, Kaido, or any proxy that you are using, and you forgot the two trailing lines?
The new lines at the end. Yeah, for
exactly,
sure, 100%.
And when you have like a system like curl or Netcat, where it's really low level and you control every part of it, and you can actually understand like what specific header or what the path is doing or what the host is doing, and just trying, I don't know, try to reach Google with Netcat and trying to do a redirect or something like that, is actually something good to learn, because you are controlling every part of your request. And I know like some really good hackers that actually for request smuggling, do not use any proxy.
Yeah.
Directly seen, goes seen on Netcat. Like
that. Yeah. And I think having that lower level ability to play around with the individual bytes is pretty useful for sure. I've done it only a couple times myself, but I think it gives you confidence as well that the system is actually as simple as you think it is. Exactly. You know, like I think there's always this for me, this sort of like fog of, yeah, maybe like, I think I understand that, but I haven't actually like played around with it and got my hands on it yet. So I think there, you know, there could be something that I don't understand there. And when you actually like just netcat and printf, you know, then it absolutely like, you know for sure, oh, I need to put this new line. I need to do that. And you see how granular the control is that you have over all that.
And that's also like this low level, like learning at the beginning, those low level stuff really going to help you in the future to trust a tool or not.
Yeah, like that's a great point.
Your reliance on the tool, like this is someone else that coded it for you, right? And so you rely on their knowledge and their coding skill. And I mean, of course, there are some amazing, amazing tools, but sometimes you need something like really specific and you don't know if the tool is going to do it or not. Like myself at the really beginning when James Kettle released the burp extension for Rika smuggling, you know, I just tried to run it everywhere and I was like, hey, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't find any vulnerability. But then I got back with a netcat request and I was like, oh, wait, why the response is like that? and that's, I feel like as a beginner, I learned something good about that. I learned like what the request was and what data was needed to be manipulated inside the request in order to reproduce a vulnerability, right? And yes, it's harder. It's not for everyone, but I think it's a good advice even for beginners or experts to just try to go deeper in your stack and understand like, okay, what am I doing right now? Like, what is really happening behind?
Yeah, you said you're not even letting this poor kid use a web browser at this point, right? Like, Ronnie is teaching this kid. And as we were walking up this mountain, Ronnie's like, yeah, man.
Breathing heavy. Yeah, the briefing is accurate.
You know, I don't even let him use the browser at this point. He's just using Perl.
I'm like, the browser is going to do so much things for you. And I want him to actually learn like the structure of the request. And like, for instance, if I don't put the right verb, what the backend is supposed to answer to me. And then I want him to go on another system and see if he got the same response. Because like something as easy as a 302 is like, okay, what's a 302? Let's go on the MDN. Okay, look at the MDN, read it, and tell me what's the 302 doing. Oh, it's a redirect. What's a redirect? I don't know. Okay, learn what's a redirect. And what's the redirect? Okay, apparently it's giving me a path to go to. Can you find the path to go to in the response? It's like, there's nothing in the body. I mean, hey,
there you go. That's a good discovery.
And that's where I told him, use Netcat, see the full request, or curl with the dash I. And they're like, oh my God, there is a location header. And like, okay, you see? And that's where I understood something really, really important, is that the tool obfuscating a lot of what it is doing. And if you really want to learn web fundamentals, it's going to help you to go to the documentation and just trying to actually generate yourself those low level requests. And
yeah, adding that VVV, on Perl and getting that actual raw, HTTP request base.
Exactly.
It sounds like, with this guy that you're working with, you're using a lot of the Socratic method, sort of like asking the question that he needs to go find the answer to. Yeah. And I think that's really helpful. And it also teaches him how to ask the correct question for himself at some point down the line. I'm just such a big fan of that education model, the Socratic method. It can be kind of a pain in the ass. Like, I'm sure this guy's going to punch you and the next time he sees you in person. But
exactly. I told him, like, if I think that the question is not good enough, I'm just going to let him answer himself, right? But if I know that I struggled myself to find the answer, I'm going to try to help him, like, find the answer faster. I think that's a good way to do, because as I told him at the beginning, you need to be able to face the wall yourself, because I'm not going to be there for your bug bounty career, and you can't rely on me, and I don't want to collaborate with you in the future.
Yeah,
maybe.
Let me be honest. I don't want to collaborate with you in the future.
Yeah, I like to do my thing on my side.
I got this guy, Rhinorator. I love to collaborate with him.
Yeah, yeah, no. He's a good dude. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's good. Okay, so we got the HTTP sort of spec, right? The RFC, the MDN. You've got browser internals. I always think it's really important for people to understand how same origin policy works, and like the whole concept of these isolated origins in the browser, and why you can't just use JavaScript to reach into an iframe and like grab some data out unless it's a same origin iframe, right? And then you can. And then understanding what sort of tools you have at your disposal there, especially if you want to become a good client-side hacker, because so much of client-side hacking is just chaining together all these little gadgets that you get into making it into something that is really impactful. Let's see, what else do we have on the web fundamentals environment there?
I think
actual structure of the backend could also be helpful,
exactly.
Like proxies and what frameworks are being used and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was going to mention that one, because this is like a huge part of what I'm also trying to teach this kid right now, is that two different backends, it's going to sound obvious, but will not implement the same standard in terms of request response, right? He sent me a message and like, hey, I did that option verb on that request and I got a 4.3. And like, shouldn't be option always give back all the headers and methods that I can reach? It's like, hey, maybe there is something in front, a layer, or maybe they did something custom. And that's where you dig. Like, this is like the hacker mindset. It's like, what happened and why it is happening and how can I use that on my in my advantage, right?
That's a good sign, though, I think, for him, you know, that he's like, oh, let me try a different HTTP verb here. And he's identified an HTTP verb that is actually supposed to like give you data about a specific endpoint and how it, you know, how it works. That's a good sign for our boy here. You know,
exactly.
I think he's going down the right path.
And the structure of the backend is like such a good thing. Like I'm glad that you put it on the thread, because like just a reverse proxy will not implement the same, for instance, RFC than the backend, right? And just because there is like two type of implementation, it creates a confusion, and you can exploit that to your advantage. And it's like a second order pass traversal, right? It's the same philosophy, the same mindset, is that you have two different layers that are not treating data the same way. And we're not talking like about a specific vulnerability, specific technology. Like this is the abstract thinking of it. Like you have several layers and you are just trying to jump from one layer to another and trying to see if they look at the data differently.
Yeah, that's a widely applicable concept, is the whole disagreement on how data should be processed, normally in input from the user. So I guess there's like that set of technology, right, where you need to understand maybe this was a little bit of an area where that tweet was lacking, is like, okay, even though we understand the fundamentals, and maybe we understand the individual vulnerabilities, I think there's some mindset things, like you were saying, like, okay, the overarching principle of mismatch in parsing data, or the universal principle of context breaks, right? Where we're breaking out, and it can be any context break, right? I talk about, you know, maybe the most benign version of this is when you have like a cookie and you're injecting into the value of the cookie, but you can also specify the semicolon and inject into the attributes of the cookie, right? Yep. That's a context break. And we also see context breaks in, you know, XSS and all sorts of injection based stuff. That's something that I haven't seen people really formalize even in like a blog post of like, what are some of the overarching hacker principles that you should have in your mind that should start triggering red flags.
This is we
that's
talked
a good about, a piece of I that's a good idea for a piece of content actually for beginners.
I think so, and that's what you know. Earlier today, Justin was struggling on a puzzle.
yes, I was. Yeah. I hate those freaking puzzles, dude.
Yeah, you know, and I think hacking is like much like a puzzle. Like,
I totally disagree with that. I think hacking is like very different than a puzzle. I'm sorry, continue. I hate these puzzles so much and I feel so comfortable hacking, so when you say that, my guttural response is like, hell no.
Yeah,
okay, but hit me.
I'm going to finish the sentence. It's much like hacking in the like abstract layer of thinking, right? You do not need to first check what is happening, like that's really hard to formulate, but you don't need to just stop at what is in front of you. You just need to think on an abstract layer, like, okay, what is happening? Like, how is my request reaching the backend? Is there anything in the middle? And like, if there is like a connection, then there is a rule. And this is my rule. This is my world. Okay. And now that I have my rule, what can I do to break it? And that's, I feel like, one of the most low-level abstract thinking that you can do. Like, I admit, at least for me, right? Like, you create a rule and you say, okay, my request is following this rule. Now, how I can cheat
or whatever, yeah.
And how I can cheat the game. And once you have like this abstract thinking, you go down to the technical layers until you write your request to hack, right?
yeah. No, that does make sense. And that is, I don't know, man, mapping it onto that stupid freaking little game, you know, is where I have the problem with that. But I think the overarching principle does apply. And it made me think also of another one of the principles is this whole concept of time of check to time of use.
Yeah.
Right? Like I love that security principle where it's like, okay, you know, there's some security check that occurs at some point that's trying to prevent you from doing something. And then after that check, that data is modified in some way. You know, the classic example for me where I think this really clicked was like back in the day was an environment in which there was a check being performed for a specific string, you know, let's say it's script or whatever, trying to prevent cross-site scripting. And then right after that, there was a replace, you know, call that would, okay, that would, you know, delete something out, right? So you could do, open bracket SCR and then, you know, whatever, it start the script tag again. And then it would pull out that middle piece and it would connect the two pieces together, right? Okay. And so that time of check to time of use, and then there being some sort of modification in between the check and the use, is another one of those overarching principles. So maybe I should append that tweet, I think, and add some of these on there as like general principles to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice idea, like trying to create like category of abstract thinking related to vulnerabilities, like even more abstract than injection, right? Like we said secondary path traversal is just because there's two layers that are not agreeing on what data, how they should pass the data, right? All the injection categories, like we are over tracing user input, and we can, like, this is a brainstorm right now.
No. It's good.
But like, if we try to break down the abstract thinking of while we are web hacking, that could help a lot of people to go like on another kind of methodology. Because I feel like there is many different methodology. There is one where you just check box everything, like every kind of vulnerabilities that you think. And maybe it's not efficient, but some people need that, right? And it's completely like a rational methodology to use, especially like if you are like me and you forget what you did earlier.
Yeah, for sure.
but then there is some other people that live in their mind. And so creating like some kind of mind map of what you think is happening and trying to first check if your mind is correct. Like for instance, hey, I think there is like one reverse proxy, a load balancer, and then I can reach the backend. But the backend is in a cluster, so I have different pods, right? How can I check that? And so you check that, and then, okay, that's my rules. Like, I'm evolving in that world. Like, this is my mind map. And that helps a lot, like just being able to confirm that the technology works in the way that you think it is, because you are like blinded.
Yeah, it's like building these hypotheses and then validating the assumptions along the
exactly.
way. Yeah, that's I think that's a part of the overarching process. And then we kind of apply these various tenets of hacker mentality onto that. So like another one that I just thought of, inspired by Kevin Mizu, you know, from the Grey Hacks presentation, is this whole concept of the mutation XSS that he presented, is the whole concept of dealing with user input that is supposed to be spec compliant in some way and is not spec compliant. So how do we deal with messy input from the user and get it back to a place where it needs to be rendered or needs to be presented in a way that's compliant with a specific specification? I think there's vulnerabilities that arise there pretty often. Another one that just comes to mind as well is, I think, could be broadly categorized as like lack of depth of understanding the technology that you're using, right? The classic example that comes into mind here is XXE, right? Where you have this XML language that is just supposed to be for like marking up data. And somehow there's like this weird feature where you can just run arbitrary code, you know, in code inside of this whole language. And then, you know, you see that as well on top of it with XSLT. And now it's like, oh, wow, this is a, you know, freaking Turing complete language that's just built in as a side component of XML. And it's like, okay, so, you know, there's so many recursive layers of technical depth to all of these systems that we're using. I mean, you see this with the dependency confusion stuff too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I really like what you just said as an abstract thinking, like developers' misconception of a technology, or maybe more lack of root knowledge. And you see that with SSRF vulnerabilities, right? So there is an SSRF. You manage to get your metadata endpoint. There is a fix. What's the fix? Okay, I'm going to just forbid the metadata endpoint. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there is DNS. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm working on another layer. Okay, I'm just going to forbid I do a DNS resolution and forbid anything that resolve to that specific IP. Yes, but an IP is just 128 bytes. Yeah. But the RFC doesn't say how you can represent that. There is a convention to represent that with the four dots, but you can also represent that in hexadecimal and in decimal. Okay, so you just bypassed the check.
You've got the DNS rebinding, and then you've got there's so many technical layers, technical depth layers. And I think if you specialize in even one of these, you know, a high overarching methodologies, then you can get a lot of vulnerabilities out of it, right? Like with these sort of things. But being able to apply all of these across a target, I think, is what kind of gives you more of an edge as a hacker, where you feel like you get to this point where you're like, yeah, you know, given enough time, I can probably find a vuln on pretty much anything, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of people are shooting for.
And one question that a lot of beginners also ask a lot in our DMs, I think, is, okay, really great advice. Yeah, I should go look at root things and then apply them to my targets. But what do I aim for? Like, what's the weird thing that I should aim for? And I guess that the answer is, like, you shouldn't start with research. You should start with maybe someone else's research. And that's an advice from Jeff Kettle. Like, I think the article is named, Hey, so you want to be a web security researcher or something like that? Don't remember the exact name, but he says, like, hunt for forgotten knowledge. So basically, take the blog post of someone that you really understood or really like the technique and you find it elegant and you know, you vibe with the technique, and you're like, okay, I'm going to try to first apply this technique on all the targets that I know and that I like. And I'm like, okay, what works and what doesn't work and why it doesn't work. And when you apply something at scale, you are going to see all the edge cases. Mm-hmm. And that's where your research that's starting.
That's really good. That's some really good data right there. Yeah.
So, and I'm saying that because that's how I started Bug Bounty. I was struggling for 6 months. It's like, I figured, like this was the everyone's beginner story, right? You do not find any vulnerability. You try your checklist, you try everything, but everyone tried the same thing. And you get like a duped open redirect and you are like at this close to just abandon Bug Bounty. And then I was like, okay, let's go to a technology that is widely used, but maybe people are not looking too into. And I went to WordPress plugins and I was like, I go to all the targets that are on HackOne and check which one use WordPress. So you learn a little bit of recon there, but just enough to have like maybe 1,000 websites or maybe even less, right? And then you just check, enumerate like all the plugins. And I was just aiming at the smallest plugins, right? And I was just checking, hey, is there an XSS that already exists on the plugin? Mm-hmm. And usually like
checking for CVEs against it, or yeah, are you saying like actually doing source code review?
Yeah, no, maybe at the beginning you just check like if there is a CVE. If there is a CVE, you have a quick win. And if there was a CVE, you check the fix of the CVE. And so you start a little bit of code review and you're like, hey, I managed to find my XSS.
That's another one of the overarching principles is the fix, yeah, right? Like checking the fix at a granular level, and making sure that it's fully technically validated. And I like that.
And so for that WordPress research, it wasn't like a huge research, but it was like a little bit of code review and everything. And one day I was doing my XSS thingy. I was doing a couple of $100, like up to 1,000. And I got to a point where, hey, this XSS is not working on this specific website. Like it works on my Docker environment of WordPress, but it doesn't work on the website. And that's where you start learning, really. It's like, what's the difference?
What is CSP?
Exactly.
That's when you learn what CSP is.
Yeah. And so you start another deep dive, and then that's where the research starts. And I'm just applying a research at a bit of a larger scale, just trying the same technique, really niche technique, and then trying to see all the edge cases, and from the edge cases, learn how you create your own research. That's, in my opinion, how you can become like a good bug bounty hunter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that at scale piece, I think is really interesting. That hasn't been an approach that I think I've implemented a lot, but I have seen that the edge case, just you know, back in the day when I was doing more recon automation, you're absolutely right. Right, as soon as you try to do something at scale, those edge cases are going to stick out like a sore thumb, right? Because they're just going to break your whole system, and it's going to be like, oh, why is this actually not working? So that is a good way to find all those little tiny little tweaks off the edge of what you would normally expect. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why sometimes I don't rely on tools where I start the research. I prefer to write my own really buggy tool, like in terms yeah, of finding stuff. Like it doesn't find like good findings. There is a lot of false positives, but I like to learn why it is a false positive, right? And if it's just a blatant false positive, I'm going to fix it. But then there is like those edge cases. Like if, imagine you are writing an XSS finder tool, a Kaido plugin or something, and then you just check if there is a reflection, right? And you're like, oh, okay, I got my reflection. Then there is XSS, right? And then you understand, oh, but there is some tags where like it doesn't pass as HTML. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, wait, but can I actually still get XSS on those tags? And then you go deeper and deeper into the documentation. You go back to the RFC, you go back to the HTML, MDN documentation, and you are like trying to understand like this freaking tag, what it is doing, because it never used since 2008, right? It was just an obscure browser that introduced yeah, that. And that company
sounds like a very specific problem that you're talking about.
Lost 8 hours of my time.
Yeah, dude.
That was 3 years ago.
I think that's a really interesting piece, though, too, because when I was giving the workshop at GraHack, I kind of said, I think one of the problems with hackers is that we often reinvent the wheel time and time again. We make the same tools. And why do we rebuild time and time again? It's because we don't trust the implementation of other hackers because it's opaque in a lot of scenarios. And I say it's opaque, you know, the source code would still be there. Yeah. But it's like, oh, okay, I've got to, you know, sort through all of this source code to make sure that it's properly implementing, you know, my methodology of this is how I would, you know, bypass a 403 or, you know, look for an fuzz for an XSS in a specific scenario, right? And so essentially what we end up doing is then we end up writing the code ourselves so that we know this is how it should be implemented, right? Because we're essentially taking our own methodology and trying to automate it, right? And build it out. So you can definitely see the various edge cases pretty well that way. But I think it's not always that piece of I don't have introspection into the tool. It's also, oh, I want to understand this more thoroughly by automating it. Yeah. And that's a good principle and something that, yeah, maybe a lot of the beginners should take a look at. Yeah. And that speaks also to the, should the beginner hacker know how to program?
Yep.
Piece of that. And how much time do you think hackers should spend on building some sort of ability in, you know, JavaScript, Python, you know, some sort of client side or like scripting language. Let's call it a scripting language versus a programming language.
Oh, that's an entire debate here.
But I mean, to do this methodology that we just described, it's necessary, right?
Yeah.
Especially with the onset of AI, I think it's a little bit tricky, right? Because you can definitely get away nowadays with, you know, prompting in natural language and then being able to read code.
Yeah.
I think. So I think it's probably not necessary, even if you're looking to even if you're looking to build that skill set in the way of automating, you know, something to understand it a little bit better, you can oftentimes do that via natural language prompting.
Yeah.
And then just modification.
Yeah. I think it's not necessary as a bug hunter to like code really well, but it's better if you code actually. I have like in my mind an entire debate because I think like I know some hackers that do not know how to code at all, right? But they are finding like some really crazy vulnerabilities because they don't have the barrier of thinking a developer might have implemented something.
Yeah, and thinking, oh, you know, a developer couldn't have been this stupid, you know, yeah, to implement it this way. Yes, they could have.
Yeah, or even like, just try some super naive and obscure thingy and just say, because they don't know that normally it doesn't happen. And just because they don't know it, they're going to test it. And it kind of worked once, you know?
Yeah. I feel like that hurts them more than it helps them, though. Because I've seen that a couple times before and I've been like, oh, yeah, you know, they tried that and then they kind of got lucky, right? But then, you know, how much time does that person spend trying things that will just not work?
Yeah.
You know, like, and I know for a fact that it will not work.
Yeah. And that's the other side of my debate, like saying, okay, but when you are going to learn, you are going to learn the concept and you are indeed going to reduce the things that you are going to try because you think that people are implementing code that way. But also by knowing more code, and I think it brings a lot more value because indeed you can automate those scripts and be able to script at least a little bit will reduce the friction.
Okay. So going back to that though, I guess, putting the scripting thing aside, we're all that guy that doesn't know that a little bit, right? That doesn't know how to script a little bit, right? Because at the end of the day, we each have our own blind spots for what kind of technology we're proficient with or that we're familiar with in any way, shape, or form. So when we're building out this, like the rules, like you were talking about, yeah, the rules of the environment that we're in, we can make assumptions on, okay, well, you know, I see this and this, which tells me it's probably a reverse proxy. But you know, you don't know that for certain. And that's that's the cool part, I think, about Bug Bounty, because Bug Bounty takes a bunch of hackers from a bunch of different spots that all have different eyes and different history and different background and different understanding of various technical components and put it all together. Because sometimes you need the dude that's gonna, you know, assume that, you know, this is the environment and that my assumption is correct, and we go super technically deep. And we tried this really obscure thing that would only work if my understanding of the stack is 100% correct.
Yeah.
And then you also have this guy that's like, what if I just put a little tick here? I wonder, you know, what that does. Or, you know, just tries all of these naive techniques to get the full coverage.
And I think you need to be both those guys. Like, this is the answer.
You need to be both of those guys?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
You need to learn, but sometimes you need, like, when nothing works and you really want to find a verbiage on the target and before, like, you've thought maybe on a podcast or on a conference or something where that I've seen that you like to learn a target until you cannot stand it anymore, yeah. Right? You want to learn the JavaScript until you need to be the
world expert on that specific application is what I normally say.
And I think that, in my opinion, before doing that, there is like the naive part that you should try it first. Like imagine I know nothing about anything. Like, I need to at least try some stuff before getting more in-depth. And then go back, even after the in-depth part, go back and just say, okay, I'm naive again, but I know a bit more. What if I tried that then? And it's not about luck or anything. It's like sometimes you are so in a tunnel that you can't see the bigger picture, right? And just take a step back and trying to avoid putting barriers in your mind because you became an expert on that specific target. And like, think, I know everything, right? You take a step back, being naive again, and you say, but maybe they just did that. And I think it helps a lot while hacking.
Yeah,
right?
I think so too. So we've covered a little bit of like, how do we get the technical knowledge? We've covered a little bit of abstract, you know, sort of high level principles about hacking. And one of the things that I think is a hard skill to teach, and some people just have it straight from the beginning and some people don't, is this whole concept of threat modeling. It is understanding where the boundaries are in an application and sort of getting those in your brain and figuring out a way to work around them. And I've got this friend, actually, you know him. He's come to some live hacking events with me. And, you know, I'll say this, you know, his technical piece is not there. He's not a IT guy, right? But the instant that I talk to him, you know, he comes up with these scenarios and he gets excited about the scenarios too. He's like, what if we could do this? Because I read this here and I read this here and I said, well, you know, what if this happened? That would be bad for the application, right? And he just has that, even without the technical piece, he has that whole understanding of like, this is how I pretend to be an attacker. And what would an attacker want to do to this application? And that just came so naturally to him. And I've definitely come up against some people where it's like, yeah, I tried XSS, I tried CSERF, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, and it's like, okay, well, you got to think outside the box a little bit here. And you got to like think about the actual trust boundaries that are not necessarily a part of the technology, right? That's what we see with CSERF and XSS, right? We're dealing with a web browser, we're dealing with HTTP. So there is a possibility of XSS and there's a possibility of CSERF. But we're also dealing with another layer of, you know, complexity as far as the technology goes that implements some business case. And that's also a system. That's also a system that we can abuse, right? That's not, you know, this technology. And so I guess a business logic vulnerabilities, I think, are just such a massive category of vulnerability that threat modeling, that getting that skill of threat modeling massively applies to. So, have you approached this at all with your mentee of sorts? And I don't know, how do you think people can address and build that threat modeling skill?
Yeah. So when I was a beginner, someone told me an advice was like, the vulnerability that you are trying to find, try to think how much on the darknet people will buy it. right?
Yeah, that's a very simple solution, but yeah, that's a good point.
And I want to go a little bit further.
that's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah, and I thought like it was such a great advice because then I was like, yeah, I understand why the XSS on this offshore website with no SOP or anything is not business relevant, actually, right? Because there's nothing that you can actually do to harm the customers or anything. And then once you understand, like, not even the business logic vulnerabilities, but also the business model of the company, like what they are selling and what are their value as a company, then you need to aim on that value, right?
That's something that I wish companies would be a little bit more clear about. You know, I wish they'd be more clear about their threat model too, but some companies, it's like, man, if you get access to any customer information, it's like the end of the world.
Yeah.
And some companies, it's like, oh, wow, if you circumvent my whole payment model, it's the end of the world. And then some companies, it's like, oh, I don't care if you circumvented my whole payment model. All I care about is avoiding fines for GDPR. You know, like it's nuts.
And you know what? Maybe it's a huge hot take, but I understand like sometimes on Fortune 100 companies that bypassing their pricing model is not a vulnerability, because most of the companies, like their business model is relying on ads. So on the data that they managed to acquire on their users, right? And so this, if there is a leak of data, it's basically as if you were managing to bypass their business model. But if you manage to find one of their tools that costs like $5 a month and you manage to bypass that, this is not like the biggest vulnerability for them.
It's a risk, you know, or it's a payoff thing for them too. It's a business decision at the end of the day, right? Is like, we accept this risk, or we assign, you know, a $300,000 a year developer, total comp developer, you know, 4 hours to actually fix this vulnerability. And okay, how much money did that just cost me versus like, okay, you know, Ronnie gets free, you know, Slurpees for life or something like that. I don't know, you know?
Like imagine e-commerce platform, you bypass you bypass the payment. Huge deal, because this is their business model. They're like that. They're actually selling stuff, right? But then you go to, I don't know, like a company that has a license, but it's not actually their mainstream of revenue. You bypass the payment. They're not doing any revenue anyway on that specific piece, and yeah, it doesn't cost them anything.
What?
So it's not like a huge vulnerability for them. And once you understand the business model, I'm not saying like they're right to not pay you or downgrade you. I'm just saying once that you understand like the business model of the company that is running, like how they make money, and you can threat that specific part, then you can do better business model, like a threat model that will F you find business logic errors.
Yeah, I get that. That does make sense. There's lots of nuance to that situation, but I think there's also this piece of that isn't always how bug bounty works, right? Like some of the people that have made the most money in bug bounty are not the ones whose vulnerabilities will be sold for the most on the dark web, right?
Yeah.
They're the ones who have learned how to game the system, and there are bug bounty hunters that just want to establish a baseline freedom in their life, right? So this is one of the things that I kind of talk about with my mentees as well is like, what is your goal for bug bounty as a part of your life, right? Do you love the aspect of like, let's dive deep and let's do security research, and would you be doing that if you weren't getting paid for it anyway? And that's where I think a lot of really successful bug bounty hunters come from. But then there's also this other side of like, no, actually, I just want to be able to be a digital nomad. Right. Yeah. And that's totally okay. You know, like I'm not going to try to shame the people that are just wanting to get back a portion of their life. Right. Because I take, you know, I have that, you know, I'm self-employed, I'm full-time bug bounty, and I love every freaking second of it. And I totally recommend to anybody who thinks they can go full-time bug bounty and pull it off to do it, because it's like super freeing. And I think in those scenarios, it's like, okay, well, I don't necessarily need to make a ton of money or get these super technical, vulnerabilities. I just need to understand how to game the system enough, how to add enough value to the right people who are willing to pay for it to, you know, get the freedom or whatever. And I do respect those programs that will pay for a vulnerability, even if it's not like something that is actively exploitable just in the name of cleaning up their attack surface.
Yeah. And I want to cycle back on something that you said is really interesting, is that what is your bug bounty goal, right? And most of the beginners, like I think that there was a HackOne report about that. I don't have like the exact numbers, but most of the beginners are here because they want to actually prove that they have enough technical knowledge to get a job, right? And that's how I used Bug Bounty.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's how I used Bug Bounty in order to get a job, because I didn't went to college. I'm really bad at classes, learning, or anything like Scholar, right? And so I was like, hey, I'm allowed to hack companies and they're willing to pay for it in a legal fashion, right? And so I should use that as my way of writing my own resume. And your approach on Bug Bounty will be different when you think like that than when your goal is to actually have like a streamline of revenue. Because here you want to find like that niche vulnerability, your golden goose that you can milk until you get another golden goose once it's expired. But then...
once the golden goose is expired. I like that.
Exactly.
It's gone stale. You know, it's a little bit... it's like the baguette we bought at the store yesterday.
Exactly. I think you know exactly what kind of vulnerabilities I'm talking about right here.
I do. Yeah. Exactly what you're talking about.
And then there is the goal of living off of it, or the goal of just having fun. And the way that you see Bug Bounty is going to change the way you are going to do the research and the methodology, right? Like if you are spending 2 hours a week in Bug Bounty, you want to find a vulnerability. If you are spending like maybe... I don't know, 20 hours a week, but you are a beginner that just want to learn how stuff works, then you don't necessarily want to find a vulnerability. You just want to actually understand how other people are managing to hack into those kind of companies. And yeah, this will adjust your methodology too, I guess.
Yeah, for me, I think I allow myself to get distracted from this a little bit, right? Because for a long time, for me, it was like, I guess... to a degree as a full-time hunter, this is still the case, but I was focused on the monetary aspect of it. It's like, oh, well, you know, I can make a full-time living off of this and I get this complete freedom in my life. And that's great. I love that, you know, and I do still have that to a degree, but I think I really care more now about doing like more technical work, you know, in-depth technical work. And I allow myself to get distracted by really good monetary opportunities. Or maybe, you know, I guess maybe I should be honest with myself. Maybe I care. It's thanks for the therapy right now, Ronnie.
Exactly.
I appreciate it, man. I think maybe I should be honest with myself and say, I actually do care about the financial aspect of it. But that I think is stemming from a place of, habit, you know, and whereas like at this point, I don't necessarily need to keep grinding on the money aspect of it. I could focus more on the security aspect and the technical aspect and get more fulfillment out of the whole thing. But I still see these opportunities popping up where I'm like, oh, you know, that seems like a good, you know, opportunity to make some good money. Yeah. So I think as you move through this different stages of your life as a bug hunter, your goals may change for it as well. And that's something you got to be aware of.
And this is also going to change like the targets you are going to hack on, right?
Yeah.
Like for instance, when I was a beginner, it was, okay, any target where I can find something.
Yeah, exactly. What's the softest target I can find? Yeah. How many times have we been asked that question? You
exactly.
know,
like... and so I had like this fantasy that private programs, you find more vulnerabilities. And then the more advanced I got into Bug Bounty, then I understood, hey, those big giant companies up there, they have like a huge attack surface, and there is not enough people to look at everything that they're exposing on the web, right? And so my hunting changed, like the target changed to more like those kind of companies that work in a system where there is like 15 principal engineers or distinguished engineers or stuff like that.
Distinguished and, engineers.
Yeah.
And, dude, I want that title. Yeah, distinguished engineer.
It's a title that exists.
Is it really?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never heard
that.
Yeah,
yeah. No, it exists. I'm not going to drop the company name, but and where you need to have a process of 15 people approving a project or a fix, right? And that kind of company has a way to exposing stuff on the internet that are way different than the smaller companies that run the private programs. And when I understood that, I'm like, hey, this is like you know, Gruyere cheese. We are in France.
Oh my God.
We're going
dude.
To talk about cheese.
Talked about cheese so much this week. I have never talked about cheese as much as I have in this past week.
That's a good point. Yeah. Like Gruyere is a cheese with holes, right? I need to put that in context. Some people don't have that in the part of the world,
God,
I guess.
Dude.
No, okay. So it's just
tell me about the cheese.
Right. Yeah, and so maybe a small startup running a private program will have like a small cheese, so a small set of holes, but giant companies has like a way bigger market share, so the cheese is big, and so there is more holes, and that's how I approach my targets right now. The metaphor works, and I will fight anyone that say otherwise.
So the cheese is big, he says.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Ronnie, this is amazing. I love getting the insight into your French mind. Every company for me is a cheese. You know? Yeah,
there is truth to it in the fact that, like, you understand that there is way more processes. There is a continuous development. So it means that one feature will get redeployed maybe 20 times in a day and with different code. And when you are targeting those kind of companies that really streamline a lot of code, you know that you can come back, let's say on Google Drive, you can come back every day, and every day there is a new request, a new feature, a new thing in the JavaScript that you didn't manage to hack. And so this is where I think I can, like, I was like a beginner and I transformed to a more advanced hunter because I knew the processes of those companies and I knew that those were the companies I wanted to target. And so this reduced the set of like, all those amazing companies that are on HackOne, Buckrowd, or any platform, like, and you don't know which one to choose. And then it reduced to like, I have 30 companies that I want to hack.
I'm in the same boat with you, man. I mean, I mostly just go after those bigger companies that are pushing code constantly as well. But I mean, not to say that the smaller companies aren't pushing code constantly. I think that they are as well. But, you know, when I was talking with Douglas Day, he's got a different approach. He just goes to each one of these little small programs and with 2K crits and just, you know, spends 4 hours, you know, and on each one of them until he finds one that's like, oh, wow, this is really messed up, you know, and then just, you know, finds a bunch of vulns on those. And so I think it's not a one size fits all sort of thing, right? It's like a per hacker.
Yeah. And that was like the beginning of the thought, I guess, is that depending on your goal and on your bug bounty goal, you are going to approach the targets differently. Like, for instance, there is those amazing recon masters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Their target is not like one company. The target is like the entire list of a bug bounty platform, right? And they're running the automation on everything. And then there is those, you know, French Rosen kind of hunters that are like, what is the funniest vulnerability I can find in the world right now?
Correlation IDs.
Yeah.
Oh my God, man. That was such a crazy drop when he hit us with that.
And those approach are all valid, but they have different goals in mind. One is to do quantity. The other one is to do quality. And both of them will get like a lot of revenue by the end of the day.
Mm.
But you might have programs might have a different perception on you. Like some programs will, if you are like this big recon master, they will see you as maybe an automation scanner that is just pinging them like once a week, you know? But there is other programs, like when you are like this amazing hacker, that are just going to see one report a year, but they're going to have a sweat on their
On the brow. I want to be the one where it's like, yo, you get a report from this and it's like, oh shit, you know? Or you build a deeper relationship with the program as well. And
exactly,
and like they're like, sup dude, nice report, you know, just finishing up the one last week that you sent us, you know, that sort of thing. I think that's a fun part of bug bounty for me.
And this human side that you say create the deep JavaScript connection, you need to know with which program you can actually create that. Because once you understand the process on them getting the vulnerability, like some programs have like their own dashboard, and they are just being fed by Bug Bounty platform, and they are not even seeing your name on the dashboard. You are just like a number.
Who cares about the reporter name? Yeah.
You are just a number, and then there is the overall dashboard seeing a trend of like, oh, we got more vulnerabilities, but we fixed those. And like, they are like, okay, we are happy about that. But then there is the programs that are like, hey, you remember when you sent that vulnerability 2 years ago? Well, we want more.
We loved that report. We have it framed in our office.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Those are great, man. Those are great.
And that's just about processes. Because, for instance, those bigger companies will have stronger processes and they want to scale. They want to scale everything. And when you scale, you remove the human side. And so you cannot create this deeper connection.
Yeah.
And I think that as a beginner, you need a deep connection to learn Bug Bounty with the people like you are working with, right? With the people you are sending reports, because they can give you the feedback that you really need.
Yeah, that's the feedback piece. That feedback piece is really important. And the feedback cycle, I think, is one of the things that I really liked about Bug Bounty in the beginning, but it's getting a little bit more challenging now as things are becoming a little bit more volatile, where you know, there's so much volume coming in that the triagers are like just, you know, kicking stuff that are valid reports, and you start thinking, is it my methodology that's messing up if you're a beginner, you know, or is it, you know, them not seeing this vulnerability from a technical perspective? And it's hard to say nowadays, really. And that's why I actually get a lot of reports where people will ping me and they'll be like, hey, I reported this bug and here's the bug, and they N8 it, and or like informatived it. And I'm like, and I always try to look at those and give them a little bit of a sanity check, right? Like, and this is not, I'm not volunteering this, by the way. Like I can't get to all of them, okay? Shit, I made a mistake to say that on the podcast.
I kind of forgot,
you know, because I'm just sitting here talking. But, you know, I try to look at those and I try to give them like, yeah, you're crazy, or no, you're not crazy. That's like a valid villain and you need to start mediation or whatever. Because it's hard in the beginning to identify whether you have correctly implemented some of these things you're trying to learn, or whether you know, you're missing something, or whether it's the triager. Most of the time, it's the hacker, just to be clear. But I think there are mistakes that happen for sure.
Yeah, and I feel that most
shit. Please, guys, don't do this to me, please.
But I feel that also most of the time when I saw that this is the hacker is because there was a misconception of what the company was actually running, like how the company was actually running. Like for instance, I have like someone that came to me like IRL, right? I'm not like answering a lot of my DMs, but in real life, and they told me, yeah, I sent a vulnerability to Snapchat, but they said that it was informative. And I was like, okay, hit me. What was the vulnerability? It's like, well, you see that when you take a screenshot on Snapchat, it sends a notification to the other person, right? But they deployed the web app, and it wasn't necessarily
the same thing. Okay,
yes, sending a screenshot. And I was like, yeah, but what's the difference with you just taking, you know, a picture with your phone, with another phone of your screen? Mm. They were like, oh, man, that's true. Because that's not like what Snapchat is trying to, like this is not like critical.
Yeah,
feature.
They're trying to add friction to that piece, right? Yeah. It's not necessarily a security boundary.
Exactly.
Those are tricky. Those sort of vulnerabilities are, you know, vulnerabilities, I'll put in quotes, are really tricky because you think you've correctly identified the threat model, and there may even be features, you know, but really at the end of the day, they're like, hey, we know it's possible. We're just trying to make it less fun. Or less easy for people to do stuff. Those are hard.
Yeah, and for instance, like really, really beginner vulnerability that I found was like you could bypass a checkbox, right? Where it was on an adult site, and you needed to say I agree to those and those and those. And I saw that the request in the backend was accepting that you could not agree, and so in the backend it was reflected that I didn't agree, right? And I was like, there is a logic problem in that request, and there is logically, right? And so I sent a report, and that's where I got the best program response because
from the adult entertainment site. Love that. Yeah.
And because they didn't tell me like this is informative, I'm sorry. They explained exactly why it is informative. And they told me, what's the difference between you changing the request and saying to the backend that you are not agreeing with those policies and you agreeing with those policies, but just lying? I'm like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. And I respectfully said, yeah, I'm dumb.
Yeah. You know, it's a lesson we all have to learn, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is funny though, when you bypass those and it does reflect it in the back end as well. And it's like, no, they didn't agree, but we're not going to stop asking them anymore. Yeah. You know, like, it's interesting. I've always wondered about the
legal implications.
Yeah, the legal implications of something like that, right? Like if I were to sue them and they were to look in their system and it'd be like, no, he declined the terms and conditions, you know? And it's like, shit, you know? You know, why did we let him use the app?
Yeah,
you
know? But then they can argue that the only way to decline is to actually put a reverse proxy. And so this is some kind of reverse engineering.
There's no threat model there, for sure.
But the thing where you think that the company, like you have the company's threat model, right? And we have been talking about that. Like there is only the company's threat model. But then there is something that we often forget. There is the state threat model, which is like all the laws that are applicable. And I saw a bug hunter that just found that there was a company that did something unlawful because of a technical vulnerability that was quite like something really similar. It was just sending a request and then sending another request, and it was doing something like regulatory that if you do twice, it's illegal for a company to do.
Yeah, I've seen this too. Yeah, this is crazy.
I think we were at the same event. Yeah. And they got like a major critical bounty because the company could have got in a lot of trouble by the state. And this is like another threat model. It's like, if you're targeting a European company, they say, oh no, your P2I, mass P2I leak is just a medium because you have a name, first name, email, and that's it. It's like, yeah, but GDPR.
GDPR disagrees with you.
GDPR says that those data are PII data. And they're like, yeah, but they're not relevant PII data. And then you understand that PII means that the more data points you have, the more identifiable someone is. And so if in your subset of data, there is at least like many European customers that can be identified to a certain location because of the data points, then there is a breach.
I like that concept of like, let's brainstorm a little bit on what other type of threat models there can be. So there's like the threat model for the actual company themselves. There's a threat model for like the locality or the region, right? Yep. If you're in the EU, it's going to be different than other places you are in the world. And then one that sort of came to mind as you were saying that was the threat model of the actual end user as well, where, you know, you've got these companies that are providing like B2B services, and there's some, or even if it's not necessarily always B2B, but there is like a B2B component of it, right? And there's some sort of integrations with these. Like if you can affect via the target you're trying to hack their B2B customers' sort of infrastructure, that may not have a giant impact on the actual company, but it does have an impact on their customers.
Yep.
That can be a massive threat model that's overlooked a lot of the time.
Yeah, I really like this, and I think that this is also part of the abstract thinking, right? Where you go to a mind map and you're trying to check all the different layers that could be applied to a threat model, to a vulnerability, or to everything. So that's when I was saying like hacking feels like a bit to me as a puzzle, because you just need to forget about what you see and you think on another layer, a new paradigm, right? Where you are trying to just find all the layers and the interconnection and just say, okay, what can go deeply wrong with the set of rules that is imposed?
Yeah, XSS is another example of this, right? Where XSS is actually, and this is why you have the scope changed sort of aspect in CVSS, is the XSS actually affects the user's browser, right? It doesn't actually affect the website. It affects the state in the user's browser. And if there wasn't a browser, there wouldn't be a vulnerability here because,
of course,
that HTML isn't actually being rendered and it's not doing anything. So there's that component. There's like the end user component. There's like this third party component. There's the state level component. There's lots of various components to threat modeling for all of these complex applications.
Wow. Yeah, and there is also like the part that is exposed, but there is also everything that is happening internally inside the company, and that we think that it's a black box, but there is actually so many little interactions that end up being on the internet, like software supply chain attacks, for instance.
Yeah, the software development lifecycle. Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, DevSecOps. Oh, you can have like all your developers one day just putting your code base on GitHub, and like no one noticed that. And I'm not going to say the company, but there is a company where there is active developers because there are like 40,000 employees in the world or something like that, where they're actively pouring internal source code on GitHub. And there is no keys or anything to look at, but you just have like internal system knowledge.
I love that for me.
Leaked. Yeah.
I love that so much.
Yeah. And that's another way of, you know, thinking about everything. If you have a mind map of this is where the company sits, and this is like the country, the region, and this is like all the threat model. And then you zoom inside the company and you're like, okay, there is that number of employees. This is the technical stack. They're doing a fundraiser right now. What can investors
doing a fundraiser? Yeah, they're raising a cycle. Yeah.
Yeah. So sorry.
Raising funds. Yeah.
Yeah. Raising funds.
Investment round. There we go. Yeah.
Investment round. So what do investors can get scared about? And then you zoom a little bit, and you're like, oh, this is the technical stack. You zoom, until you mind map everything, and that's how I think we need to approach bug bounty. Is about abstract thinking of all the threat models.
You need a company who's on board for that, because there aren't a lot of companies that will say, yeah, just anything that affects us, we want to know about, right? You see, you have a couple of those, but not all of them. I love that piece of Epic Games scope. It's like, anything else that we own and you can prove it, we'll pay for that.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty great. Yeah. That whole overarching principle of looking at those lost components of the software development lifecycle, these internal ticketing applications, the correlation ID stuff with the logging and introspection. How does the SOC, how does the blue team actually investigate these incidents as they're occurring? And what sort of hindrances can you put into play, or how can you leverage that investigation to trigger other vulnerabilities. Yeah.
And as a beginner, that can feel so overwhelming, right? And I think...
Yeah, we kind of got off the... No. Sorry, beginners that are trying to listen to this and thinking like, holy shit, there's a ton of things I don't understand.
No, because I think this should be like some kind of North Star, like to be able to understand that many layers, but you need to start with the layer you are most comfortable with. And more than comfort is like the one that sounds the most interesting to you, right? Again, as a beginner, when I was starting, like the most interesting thing at the time was XSS, like so many beginners. And then there was like the request smuggling, and I was like, what is that? It's so interesting. It's so elegant. And so I wanted to find request smuggling. And then I learned from that. And even all the knowledge that does add up in a vulnerability, sometimes, someday, you are going to go on an obscure application and you are going to say, damn, this thing that I learned like 4 years ago is going to be useful today. And I feel this happened to me recently. I was working with Shlomi, and he did a blog post about that, where he just pinged me on Discord and he was like, hey, I have like this, I think it was 40 character hash, and I have the feeling that it's predictable. We should, break it. And so the first 8 chars were a timestamp, and then everything felt so random. And I advise you to read the article. But the way I was thinking about this breaking was like a technique that I learned like 4 years ago on an obscure CTF, and where they were like, okay, let's guess what the hash is doing. Like, what is computed, and just trying like different methodologies until you get the right prediction pattern, right? And because I read that 4 years ago, I was like, oh, maybe I can find it back and get their methodology. And I never used it in 4 years, but the knowledge was useful at some point. Yeah. So everything you do to learn something will be a payoff, even if you don't find
it. Yeah, it intertwines into other things down the line for sure. All right, man. What else do we have on this beginner front? We didn't really cover the tweet like we actually planned to here. I guess the tweet actually says, okay, web fundamentals, and then we go into a different set of various
kind of vulnerabilities,
classes as we move into month 3, 4, 5, 6, and then 6 through 8 we're doing code review and actually developing sort of our speciality as a hacker. I think that piece of understanding these various vuln patterns like XSS and CSurf and that sort of thing, yeah, those have a couple really solid purposes, right? They teach you those vuln classes, which you see, you know, on lots of targets, so you can just apply it directly. But they also apply some of those higher principles, like we kind of, like, yep, we talked about injection. Okay, injection is this concept that I need to apply more widely. And I think you kind of get that through osmosis as well. You know, it's not necessarily something you're studying and being like, oh yeah, okay, context breaks, that makes sense. It's more of like, oh, okay, that's what context breaks looks like actually implemented. And then, you know, if my brain is trying to abstractize things, then I can start
seeing.
Here
you go, man.
Yeah, yeah. So this is what you were talking about before. Yeah. So it's there's dual purpose to actually learning those actual vuln types and seeing how they're implemented. Yeah.
Yeah, and also I feel that when learning those vuln type, you don't need to learn all of them right ahead before starting to try to find them. I feel like you need to pick one, the most fun one, right? The one you are resonating with. And you are just going to understand, like, in depth, what are the edge cases of those techniques? Let's, for instance, pick SSRF. Mm-hmm. SSRF, really pretty much widespread, came in the top 10, new OS per top 10. And there is like so many fixes that are wide on the internet. Like if you just try to go type on the internet how to fix SSRF as a developer, right? You are going to see all the fixes, and you are like, what the developer must have implemented first, you know? And so you learn those edge cases, and that's where you come back to the RFC that you've learned before, and you're like, okay, so what is an IP? What is a domain name? How can I bypass the fixes? And you go so in niche that you can just try to just concentrate on that niche until you get sick of it, and then you go to the other vulnerability. And I think Kevin Mizu did, for me, he's one of the best trajectory in bug bounty right now. I feel like there is some other amazing people like Riotac or Matan that are doing like an amazing job on that trajectory. And Kevin is one of them, where he took XSS, right? Everyone is taking XSS as a beginner-friendly vulnerability somehow, right? He took XSS, and he wasn't like, I'm going to find like reflected XSS on all the endpoints. I'm going to check the biggest implementation of DOM XSS like fix, and I'm going to be specialized on how to bypass this implementation. And then he went to learn how to bypass DOM Purify. This is a bit more research, right? But he had to learn so many stuff. Like, I talked with him about that. Like, he had to learn the RFC. He had to learn how to read the Emacs script.
The payoff is massive too, right? Yeah. Like, you see this with just moving into talking about specialization. You see this with Alex Chapman, right? With the headless browser stuff.
Exactly.
You know, Mizu with the DOM Purify sort of aspect. Johan with the CSP related stuff, right? You become the go-to person for the specific problem or the specific stack. And yeah, I mean, I think Alex was saying that almost all of his bugs this year were collabs. Yes. and he's crushing all of his goals just because people are like, okay, here's RCE, you know, but I can't implement it because I don't know how to do, you know, V8, you know, binary exploitation attacks. And he kind of bridges that gap. That specialization piece is really nasty if you can master it.
Yeah, and you don't need to over-specialize. It's just maybe about going in outside the comfort zone of the other people, right? Like, you are in bug bounty competing against the knowledge of everyone else that is hacking on the same target, right? And so they have a limit to their knowledge, especially if they're hacking generally as a checkbox, right? And so you go to your XSS vulnerability and you're like, oh, I don't want to find reflected XSS. I just want to find dumb XSS. And then in dumb XSS, you're like, oh, I just want to find post message based XSS. And just, this is like a second layer of abstraction, but just post message XSS is a bit widespread currently. And so if you take the vulnerability by like, what is the nichest way to exploit it, and you just try to find that as a beginning, you'll find way more vulnerabilities in my opinion, that if you try to learn everything and hack in a general manner.
Do you think you should do that after or before you've sort of covered the general basics of all the vulnerability classes?
I think it depends on how much fun you're having, right? This is the hacking mindset, to go deep and deep into the rabbit hole. And so if you don't like SQL injection, don't go learn SQL injection.
Amen to that. Hate SQL injection.
I don't really like it. I'm not.
It feels good. I mean, it's a good vulnerability when you get your hands on it, but I'm not passionate about it. You know.
Yeah. It's not like something I enjoy searching, but I do. For instance, enjoy searching.
The dependency confusion.
Yeah, for any software supply chain attacks. But I was in my head, I need to stop talking just about that.
All I can think about is supply chain. Yeah.
No, because it has been like something I'm trying to
specialize
into.
You've done GraphQL DOS, you've done you know, lots of other vulnerability types
for instance,
as well.
Exactly, GraphQL, like this is like a technology that is pretty much in every major companies, and you can find like some GraphQL somewhere, right? And there is like so much of an attack surface on GraphQL alone by default, that if you have fun learning just GraphQL, go just for GraphQL. But you need to understand if what you are doing, there will be a payoff to that. If your goal is to not just have fun, but also have the financial reward, you need to say, hey, that obscure technology or that obscure niche vulnerability, how much of that I can really find.
What do we think are the top, if we had to list right now, the top high value things for a beginner to dive deep into? Well, what are some of the ones that come to you? I mean, GraphQL is a great one. I think GraphQL is still very widely applicable. You just mentioned post-message XSS. Yeah. I think that's big.
WordPress technologies.
Yeah, WordPress,
Are still pretty big. I feel any framework or CMS with special vulnerabilities, for instance, if you like to hack on Rails, there is like an interesting attack surface that is just Rails specific, right? So any framework, maybe even libraries, for instance, Dom Purify is a library, right? But the attack surface of Dom Purify is gigantic. There is like a Dom Purify maybe in every React front end that I've seen so far. Not every, but like
yeah, I mean, but a vast majority, pretty much anything that has any sort of developer base in it, right? Like you're allowing the user to be also a developer with your tool, needs to have some sort of piece of that.
An advice that I can give maybe to bug hunters, and that I feel it's a good idea, tell me if it's a good idea, is instead of messaging all the top hunters or the one that are successful in what they're doing because they're receiving hundreds of DMs, go message a developer of the technology you are trying to hack, like someone on LinkedIn.
They're pretty responsive, man, to be honest. At least that's been my experience, just kind of talking to these people that are passionate about these projects. Yeah.
If you want to hack on Rails, go talk with a Rails developer and just ask them, like, how do you implement your code? You don't need to really know how to code a Rails application in order to hack it. You just need to at least understand the fundamentals, right? The abstract of it. And so just ask, hey, what's your developer lifecycle when you deploy such application? And then try to think, okay, that's how he's doing it. So I need to hack it that way. Mm. And I feel that's like a good piece of advice. Yeah. Like if you go niche, try to be part of the ecosystem that you are targeting. Like if you are hacking on WordPress, go follow some WordPress developers, go follow the discussion.
Get some data feeds for those.
Just go into the developer community because they are the one producing the vulnerabilities. Like, your top hunter, like for instance, you, when I message you, you are not producing any vulnerabilities, you are finding them. But the guys that the people that have producing those vulnerabilities are just out there, right? And they are talking publicly, and you can go learn from them their mistakes, right? And I think I've learned more talking to developer about code review stuff than actually to hackers.
Yeah, man, there have been some really crazy times in the live hacking events where I'll come up to the developers on like the first day and I'll be like, hey, if you were going to search for vulns in this code base, where would you look? And sometimes they'll be like, screw off. Like, you know, I'm not going to tell you that, you know, but sometimes they'll be like, oh, you know, I really think this is sketchy. Right. And I just remember one live hacking event where I did that and it was just so sketchy, the whole area that they pointed me to. Yeah. And I found like 15 bugs on that. And I was like, man, that was a really good call. Ben taught me that actually, that trick.
And for the people that don't have access to live hacking events, like more beginner people, like just talk with some people on the internet that are actually developing those technologies. Like there is, like in web hacking, there is some Discord, there is some forums, there is some Twitter accounts, and that I think could be quite responsive.
Yeah, just going back to the like what niches could be good right now. I think there's an area for somebody who is a gadget master, like somebody who really just builds automation solely around collecting non-vulnerability gadgets. You know, like let's say I need some ability to redirect on the specific target, right? It doesn't even necessarily be an open, it could be a semi-open, it could be, you know, whatever. I just need some ability to redirect on a target, having that, you know, around. I need a CSP bypass that's on this specific domain. I need, you know, a cookie set gadget, you know, around, right? It's having somebody who their specialty, their niche could be collecting those gadgets and then working with the community to fill the needs of various exploits. And you kind of see that with Eric, right? Eric does that to a certain extent, but I think he focuses more on gadgets that are also vulnerabilities rather than gadgets that are not vulnerabilities in and of themselves. Local storage, if you're able to like poison or invalidate some data in local storage, right? That could be a gadget. Yeah. Those sort of things could be interesting.
Maybe also SSO. Mm. Anything related?
Dude, that's a good one. Yeah.
OpenID Connect implementations.
That one's crazy, actually. Yeah. If you master that, that would be really cool.
Yeah, and I feel that this is more like a developer implementation, and that you don't really need to learn that much of HTTP to be able to at least find some vulnerabilities.
Just know SAML. Like, if you just master SAML alone, I feel like that would be, and we've seen that actually. There's a hacker that's going to come on in the pod at some point when the vulnerabilities that he wants to talk about have been patched. I mean, somebody who does that. And I think there's room for more of those as well.
Yeah. The principle, if you want to go to a niche, is like, your niche should be a niche of expertise, but not a niche of implementation, right? Because there are some people that focus like on a technology that is used maybe by maybe 100 companies in the world, right? And there is some bigger technologies that no one has a security expertise on, and that is not, I would say, not too hard to build it, right? For instance, you can focus solely on Laravel. Laravel is getting bigger and bigger every year, and I feel that there is like a huge PHP community in security that is targeting it, but not that much bug hunters, right? That could be a niche, right? Because widely implemented, but not enough expertise or eyes on.
Yeah, we've seen the ticket trick stuff before, right? When you're focusing on these sort of ticketing systems. One of the things that I've, and this is sort of related to the post-message XSS, because most of those are actually implemented, you know, a lot of the post-message XSS occur in these sort of gadgets. But I think a lot of times you'll see on like the www or on like the marketing website for a specific company, you'll see these like little chatbots that are meant to, you know, connect you to a salesperson or like help provide support or whatever. And a lot of times these are implemented just by dropping a JavaScript file onto the main site. And then they need to communicate back to their, you know, main, their iframe or like their main server in some capacity. So you see the post message stuff there. I think those things are riddled with vulnerabilities. Yeah. And I have a couple 0 days actually. I need to talk to people about how to spray in those specific plugins, common ones.
Yeah. But, and this is like depending on how much knowledge you have, how you will approach those niches. But I don't think you need to be like a really an expert before diving into a niche. As I said, when I started bug bounty hunting, I just tried to find any vulnerabilities in WordPress plugins. That's a niche, right? But because WordPress is so much implemented, there is so much plugins, there will be a lot of vulnerabilities.
It's a reflection of the rest of the ecosystem too in the WordPress environment piece, right? Like, you know, sure, WordPress plugins, you know, you get the source code and stuff like that, which is not something you see always, but they're vulnerable to the same sort of thing as other things, right? CSERF, you know, XSS, SQLi, if you're lucky, you know, that sort of thing. So especially those niches that are reflections of the bigger system as a whole.
And when I was trying to find vulnerabilities on WordPress plugins, I was just concentrating on XSS. It was just so it's a niche.
So you weren't even looking at the other own types.
No. If it was obvious to me as a beginner, I was like, okay, I'm going to search for it. But not everything was obvious to me when I was a beginner, right? And so, but something that I understood at the time was XSS. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to find XSS on those plugins. And if I don't find anything in the plugin, I will go to another target and do that again until that one day I didn't have any more targets or any more plugins. And I was like, okay, let's try a new approach.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, lots of niches to be explored. I'm trying to rack my brain. It's late. It's getting late here, so I'm not much left in there for racking. But definitely tons of niches. I'm interested to hear what the community drops in the comments as well, and like interaction on Twitter afterwards, because there's always like, you know, whenever we talk about these sort of segments, people always are like, you know, what about this? What about that? I think that'll be helpful for the community.
I think if it's possible for the beginners, like watching the podcast, or maybe on the comments or on Twitter, to tell us like what was the hardest part of learning web hacking, or what is the current struggle. Because, and I'm not talking like about finding a target or anything, it's just about like really the core knowledge. What is it for them right now? Because I, in my opinion, again, when I was a beginner, I hit so many walls. And the only struggle that I really had was the motivation, right? Like it was the resiliency that when I was hitting a wall, what could I do to, you know, overcome the obstacle? And that motivation was like my main struggle. But I know there is some other struggles that are more like on the technical side and less on the human side. And I think it will be cool to know what are those and how like people can facilitate them.
What was your biggest success in overcoming that motivation piece?
It's when I found, like for me, it was when I found my niche, right? Like when I created a comfort zone that was outside of the other people comfort zone, but where I felt like I had the expertise right now on that subject.
Do you think that was because you were experiencing success, or do you think that was because you respected yourself as a hacker?
I think it's because I had an hypothesis and the hypotheses were getting truer and truer. And so I got confidence into what I was doing.
So probably more success.
Yeah, I feel so. Like I'm the that part of I would say the researcher, security researcher community, that I can't say that I'm a really hacker, because you need to say you know, like, originally to say that you're a hacker, you need that other people to say that you're a hacker, right? Because a hacker is your North Star, is like what you want to become, and this is something that you always need to grow and trying to evolve, right? And I feel that sometimes we forget that we are not at the top of our field and our knowledge, and that we need to go further. So I'm not considering myself as a hacker, because I want to one day become like a true lead hacker.
Yeah, you've always got this moving picture of like what the ideal is. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what drives me, that motivates me, is that one day I can grasp the idea of being a hacker. And I feel that, yeah, again, that depends on your goal. Like, do you want to become a hacker? Do you want to become a bug bounty hunter, a security researcher? Like, you need to figure out that and create motivation around that.
I think we have to hack the motivation as well. That's one of the things that I kind of talk about with the...
Did you say hack the motivation?
Yeah. You got to hack the motivation as
you
well,
you want
right?
to hack everything, right?
I mean, you got it, right? I mean, because at the end of the day, that's one of the biggest challenges. And I think one of the things that I say about hacking the motivation is, you know, identifying when you're making progress, even though it doesn't feel like progress. Yeah. When you're covering endpoints, when you're finding gadgets, those are all progress. And I think as a beginner, as you're starting, one of the nice things about having like a checklist or whatever is like, okay, I can check off this little piece and I can say, okay, well, you know, I am making some progress here. Yeah. Whether it's in your learning curriculum or whether it's in, you know, your actual assessment saying, okay, well, I've assessed this target for XSS on this one endpoint, you know, that's progress. And I, you know, you trust that progress or that progression is a part of validating your hypothesis on whether this whole process will get you to the point of you know, finding a vulnerability or being a hacker or whatever you want to delegate as your actual end goal. And then, you know, if it doesn't, just like you do when you're hacking, you have to adjust your hypothesis and say, okay, well, maybe this isn't really how it works, right? And then you construct a new hypothesis and you keep on pushing with that.
So you do abstract thinking.
I can do abstract thinking.
No, I know you can, but
I'm not an abstract thinker.
We're just circling back to that, like to the fact that you need to think on another layer. And that I feel that's the real entry point of actually starting your bug bounty career, even if you're like already an expert of insecurity or like a beginner in everything, is that your ability into thinking differently than just what is in front of you, right? If that makes sense. I don't know if you have like a better wording for that.
No, I mean, I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think you've got to think, you know, you could say think outside of the box. It's a bit of a cliche, but trying to pop up that extra layer, right? It's almost like one of those techniques you implement in meditation, right? Like I remember like closing my eyes and trying to focus on, you know, my breathing or whatever. And then the coach, the meditation coach or whatever would say like, oh, you know, you're going to have these thoughts come to your mind and you make sure you don't like, you know, push that, you know, get too upset with yourself when that actually happens. You just kind of have the thought and then you just, bloop, you pop right out of the thought and go one layer higher. And I think you can go one layer higher or you can go one layer lower in hacking, and you can see results on both sides of those.
Yeah, it's like walking the path and visualizing the path that you are going to walk. Mm-hmm. Like this is two different things and two different ways of hacking.
Dude, you think we're high right now, you know?
No.
We're sitting here like, yeah, man, it's like all of hacking is like a cloud and you just pop out of it.
I feel that metaphor really helps though.
Yeah, you think so? Okay, well that makes one of us. All right, man, you want to wrap it there?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, that sounds good. Thanks for coming on, dude.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Peace. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.